Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. This is me, your host, Dr. James Kelly. Today on the episode, I had the pleasure to speak with Mr. Richard Rossi, CEO of Da Vinci Education. And here's a little snippet of our conversation.
I remember the night she died. I was sitting by the edge of her bed. And you have to really appreciate, James, that she sacrificed everything for me. And I knew she was dying. She knew she was dying. There was just a few hours left. And I said to her, "What do you want from me? What do you want from me? You did all this for me. What do you want?" And she said, "I want you to help people."
And with that in his mind, he set off on a 26-year endeavor to help the youth, help high-achieving youth figure out where they fit in the world, find out their own tribes. So today on the episode, I had the pleasure of speaking to Mr. Richard Rossi, CEO of Da Vinci Education. Also, just note that I am not taking a break like I thought I was going to. I'm going to spend some time next week, and I'm going to basically upload 10 episodes of the Diversity Inclusion series that I did for University of Western Australia back in October. So you'll be hearing that through December. And then I'm back on in January with full-length interviews again. So I'm looking forward to that. And enjoy those, too. There are actually some really interesting ones, and there's some longer ones that will be played in January as well. So remember, just go to my website if you want the full-length episode of Richard and I's conversation, and leave your adversity moment. All right, everyone, have a great week. All right, welcome to another episode of Executives After Hours. Today's episode, I love that I have this guest on the show. I love that this guest's history is in education. I love that everything he stands for is about the youth and advancing people's lives. So thank you today for Mr. Richard Rossi for stopping by the show. How are you, Richard?
I'm great. I'm really psyched to be here. Very appreciative of the opportunity.
I'm the one who's appreciative at the end of the day. Just to give my audience a quick 10,000-foot view, can you just kind of describe where you work and where you live right now?
Sure. I live in Washington, D.C. I've been here since I was 18. I went to Georgetown University, have lived in basically a four-block radius ever since. I'm 62 years old now. It's either awesome or horrifying. I'm not sure which.
Does it depend on which block you lived on at what point of your life?
Yeah, absolutely. And my whole life has always been about inspiring high-achieving kids to actually achieve all they can and to see a huge future for themselves and play the biggest game they possibly can. And that applies not only to high-achieving kids, but of course to all kids. And we can get into that a little bit, but that's my world.
And so what's the name of your organization right now?
Our whole thing is Da Vinci Education.
And so where does that come from?
Well, Da Vinci, of course, one of the greatest geniuses of all times, maybe the greatest. There are four or five different types of geniuses, and he's the only one in recorded history that has all five. Our motto is genius inspired, and it goes to the fact that there's genius within us, and that young people often don't see that genius within themselves, and it's our job to make sure that they do.
So your progress is judged by, you know, your journey that you've been on in your whole entire life. So where does Richard come from? Like, where were you born and raised?
I was raised in Greenwich, Connecticut, which is about 30 minutes outside of New York City. My parents were immigrants escaping the Nazis in World War II. I was raised by my mother. My parents were divorced when I was in the second grade. And it's really quite a story about their whole coming to this country and what they went through and what I went through growing up.
Well, describe that to me. Like, what does that mean in terms of what they went through and what you went through?
My parents met in Venice during World War II, both Jews, my father from Italy, my mother from Austria, and then they came to this country. So one of the interesting things is, like a lot of Jewish people that immigrated during that time, they decided they were going to hide their religion and their heritage because it was, quote, too dangerous to be Jewish, unquote. And they were really scarred from the World War II experience. So I was brought up my whole life having no idea of my Jewish heritage until I was in my 30s. And then that came as just a little bit of a shock to me. And right? and it was a really...
I feel like it was one of those like, hey, Richard, you're Jewish, pass the potatoes.
Yeah. You know, FYI.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because I was brought up going to various, you know, we'd go to the Christian Science Church for this and we'd go to the Catholic Church for that and Presbyterian Church for that on different holidays. And the weird thing is it never seemed odd to me. I just, you're a kid, you just go with it. But my mom really brought me up and she had lost all of her family in World War II, her mother, her father, her sister, her aunt. And it's something she never experienced, never recovered from, never. So
how did she get out then? How did she get away from all that?
Well, she had the instinct that she needed to leave, and she did on one of the last opportunities to do so. And she begged her parents to come with her, and they, like so many people, said, "I don't think it's going to get worse. We'll be fine." And at that point, the door closed, so to speak, and they couldn't get out. In addition to the pain of losing her family, she also had survivor's guilt, intense survivor's guilt. So what I didn't realize being a boy and just kind of living my life and growing up is that I don't think there was a day in her life that she wasn't in pain and suffering and feeling this enormous sense of anxiety and guilt and intense sadness and remorse over her life.
Did she ever talk about it?
No. Well, she would talk a little bit about her family because she wanted me to know my origins. But she wouldn't personalize it to herself. But it was really clear in retrospect that she was white-knuckling it every day. And as a result of that, and I being an only child, I was her pride, her joy, but I was also her whole hope for her redemption, because there was nothing else. It was just me. And we were extremely poor.
So you have this mom who clearly puts you at the center of everything in her life, which, you know, I think every mom does. My mom, I've got two older brothers. They're both a little bit derelict. And so I'm kind of her pride and joy on many levels. So I can relate to that in a lot of ways in terms of the parent putting the focus on you. But where was your dad after your mom and dad got divorced?
So my dad lived in New York City, and I would go see him on the weekends and one weekend a month. And he was a good guy. He was a newspaper reporter and an author and a photographer. He worked at the United Nations and very intellectual person. He just never really had the ability to make enough money to support a family. But when I look back at it now, I don't think of him as a bad man. I just think of him as someone that was not able to provide. And that was a problem, obviously.
Yeah, sure. But did you ever get frustrated because, you know, it was once a weekend or once a month for a weekend? Did you ever feel like you wanted more from him, especially through those early teen years?
It worked out pretty well, actually. I always felt I, when parents are getting divorced and they talk to me about it or I hear about it, I say, look, there's only two things that matter. Number one, the child needs to know that both of you love him or her. And the second is they need to know they're not responsible.
So, all right, I kind of want to get into the meats and potatoes here, if you will, for lack of a better analogy, of you going to Georgetown. Your mom obviously sacrificed a lot to get you into Georgetown. What was it like going to Georgetown? You know, I always in my mind perceive it as a fairly wealthy school, as being a child who doesn't come from wealth. Like, how did you fit in? Did you find it liberating to be in a high achieving environment? Did you know that you wanted to go into education when you were there? And, you know, that this is kind of like your thought process while you were there.
It's really interesting. I moved to Washington with my mom, and about 6 months or a year into my education, my father left and went overseas. And one day, the checks just stopped coming because he was providing some support. And that was it. Like, there was no warning, nothing. It was just 1 minute we had money, and the next minute we couldn't even eat. And at the time, I was working as an intern on Capitol Hill for my United States senator. And I went to him and I said, I need a job. And unbelievably, at the age of, I guess it was 19, he gave me a full-time job. And I put on a tie and a jacket and a suit, and I wore that thing until I was 40 years old. And I worked during the day, and I went to school at night. So I didn't really have that experience. And in fact, the people I went to school with at night were mostly also folks that were working. So I didn't have, I never had the college experience. I never lived in the dorms. It was never, you know, toga, drinking contests, you know, pong, you know, beer pong. I never had any of that. And then when I was 24, my mother got a brain tumor and died. So with her gone, and
so how did you deal with that though? Like that, I mean, that's a traumatic thing for someone who's an only child.
Yeah, it was. I remember the night she died. I was sitting by the edge of her bed, and you have to really appreciate, James, that she sacrificed everything for me. And I knew she was dying. She knew she was dying. There was just a few hours left. And I said to her, what do you want from me? What do you want from me? You did all this for me. What do you want? And she said, I want you. And I thought, well, okay, I could be a lawyer. I could be a social worker and so on. And then I realized she wasn't talking about that. She was talking about humanity. She wanted me to help humanity. And I remember so clearly thinking, well, that's never going to happen. And then a few hours later, she did die. And I was working at full time in the Senate. And that was just a couple of years before I started my first business. And coming all the way forward now to where I am now, I actually think and I just was thinking about this a couple of years ago, actually did achieve her wish.
So I guess the question I have in my mind, though, is how did you deal with it? I mean, again, I kind of go back to your dad stops providing paychecks, so I'm assuming he kind of falls out of the picture. Your mom passes away. And in my mind, I feel like you're on an island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, kind of just trying to figure shit out.
Well, so I'm 24 years old. I have a full-time job. I have a...
Which, by the way, you've never really had a chance to be a kid or a college kid for that matter. Like, you've had to be an adult.
Super young age. And as a result, I had money and I had a lot of colleagues who are also friends of mine, because on Capitol Hill, when you're working in an intense political environment like that, you have a lot of friends that are part of your circle. So I had a really good support system and a couple of dear friends who lived in the area. And I guess, I mean, that's an interesting question. Now that I think about it, I probably suppressed it a lot and just decided that I was going to go on with my life.
Head down and truck on.
Yeah. I think that's.
Did it ever rear its head up in other ways? Like, did it ever like commitment issues or fear of, yeah, I mean, commitment issues or someone leaving you, or like, did you ever see it come up someplace else in your life?
That's a really good question. I can't think of it. I think that I actually didn't have that kind of boomerang effect on me. I did manage to reestablish a relationship with my dad, which was a really important part of kind of surviving the whole thing. And I remember sitting there with him going, look, I'm not going to, you're never going to talk about my mother. I never want to hear a word about her from you because you haven't earned that right. But I'm willing to just do a reset here. And if you're willing to do a reset, I'm willing to do a reset. And of course, he instantly said, yes, absolutely. He was willing to accept whatever terms I put out there. And as a result, we saw each other quite frequently, a couple of times a year. He lived in Paris until he died. And we had a pretty good relationship. And that really, really helped. It really helped because I didn't feel like I was alone.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm sure for him, he also felt like maybe you as an adult
had
an opportunity to reconnect with you as a human being, not as a child, which is a different relationship all the way around. So what was the job or company you started after you left government?
Well, it's funny. I had this idea to start a company that would computerize political campaigns, because at the time, this was before the PC, most political campaigns were run out of like shoeboxes, right? Of people, various supporters and contributors and so on. It was all a manual process. And I thought, wow, it would be really cool to create a database system, a way to keep track of all of this and do financial reports and do thank you notes and do mailings, because this was before email, of course. And so the funny thing is, I never thought of myself as an entrepreneur. I never even thought this was a big deal. I just had an idea and I was like, what the hell? Let's give it a shot. And there was actually a guy who worked in the Senate office with me who came from a very wealthy family, and he was willing to put up some money. And I had a friend who was an engineer, and he was willing to do the programming. So it was one financier, a staff of two, including myself. And we just set up an office and began developing this software on a PDP 1123, which is a shared machine, right? And it was a central computer, mini computer, with dumb terminals, and went about our way trying to create Campact Systems, it was called, the first company I ever started. But I thought the word entrepreneur was very like hoity-toity and full of itself. I mean, I never. It was such a not big deal to me. It was just like, what the heck? Let's give it a shot.
So as you're doing this, though, like, when did you realize it was going to take off and be successful to whatever degree you want to define success?
The first business was not successful. The first business was a failure because we were never able to produce stable software. And what it did for me over those two or three years was it gave me an MBA the hard way. And I learned, right? And I really learned a lot about marketing and business and just all those things. And at the end, it failed. The man put up the money, lost all his money. and it just wasn't to be. But that kind of led me into the world of young people and education.
All right, so let's talk about that. I mean, I mean, obviously that's where you've spent the next 30, 40 years of your career,
is
working with these high achievers. So how did this journey manifest itself, right? Where did you decide, you know what, I want to focus on these high achievers? And
It's a great story. And I'm going to truncate it because it's a pretty long story. I'm going to truncate it to 2 or 3 minutes maximum. Basically, when I worked in the Senate, one of the things I did was I ran the senator's summer intern program, which brought kids down from Connecticut to see government in action and to go to the three branches, the executive, the judicial, and the legislative, see how it operates, also do other things like go to embassies and meet with members of the press. And after a week or so, these kids really had a better understanding of the obligations of citizenship and democracy, that you shouldn't just be taking, that you need to get involved, that you should be part of the system, part of the process, part of the solution. And I thought it was awesome. I really did. I had a great time doing that program, and they were really smart kids. And then a series of events happened, and this is where I'm just going to sort of jump over it because it's a long series of events. But I formed a friendship with a lady who was quite a bit older than me, 25 years older than me, and was a school teacher from Connecticut. And she and I, at a certain point as CAMPAC was failing, thought, well, let's try one program to bring kids to see an inauguration of a president, which up to that point had been for the rich and the powerful and the people who are donors and things of that nature. But think about it for a minute. This is the peaceful transfer of power in a democracy. We don't shoot the losers. We don't exile them. We pass the mantle of power peacefully on a stage. It's a beautiful thing to observe. It's the thing that makes us such a magnificent system of government. Or as Churchill said, the worst system of government in the world, except for all the others. And so we did it. I had a little bit of direct mail knowledge because I'd done some consulting for the Republican Party. I mean, little, like tiny. I'd seen a few of their packages. I basically adapted, which is a nice word for stole, the whole idea of one of the packages from them. We had $5,000, $2,500 each. We did one mailing to principals, asking them to nominate their best student to come to this. We gave it a name, the 1984 inauguration, big kind of just a fancy name. And we wrote to every member of Congress and said, would you be on our honorary board of advisors? And 90 of them said, I don't know who you are, but sure. And so now we had 90 members of Congress on our letterhead. We did this one mailing. We promised the kids that they would see the president being sworn in and go to the inaugural ball. We had no tickets to the swearing in. We had no tickets to the ball. And lo and behold, it worked. We had an enormous response. And
now, man, that is ballsy, by the way.
Well, I guess in retrospect, I don't know what the hell we were thinking. And then we had to go out and we went down to I remember Barbara, my partner, and I drove out to the inaugural committee and we said, we need 350 tickets to the ball. And they just laughed. I mean, they were like on the floor laughing. They're like, you know how much people work to get two tickets? But at the end of the day, we managed to get those damn tickets. And those kids came to the inauguration.
What did you do to get them?
We met a woman who took pity on us. And she actually was running an official ball that was just for kids, a youth ball. And she just helped us. She managed to get those tickets set aside for us. It was really just an act of pity, I guess, or just realizing that these poor kids were going to come to Washington and were expecting it. And she wanted to help make sure that they weren't disappointed. It was great, really. Then let me just say, dear listeners, do not try this. This is an incredibly bad idea. I mean, we really, this would have just been so terrible if it hadn't worked out. I don't even want to think about it. So, but it did.
So what was the business in there? Like, what was the business? I'm trying to figure out where you earned money.
It was awesome. It was all tuition driven. It was like a private school. Every one of those kids paid us money to come. Right. And we had every staff person was a volunteer. My mother-in-law was a volunteer. My girlfriend was a volunteer. My friends from Connecticut came down to volunteer. So at the end of the whole thing, we'd made like a $60,000 profit. We thought, this is awesome. Of course, we didn't factor in the fact that no one was being paid.
Yeah.
Right.
Or that it happens every 4 years.
And it's only quadriannual. Yeah. And so a couple of days after the end of the event, which was a huge success and the kids loved it, we got to thinking, well, could we form an organization to do this on an ongoing basis to help kids come to Washington, learn about civics, learn about democracy? And a few days later, we formed Congressional Youth Leadership Council, which was our first organization, and just did another mailing out of that $65,000 that we'd earned, and that mailing worked also. And just to put things in perspective for those that are listening that are not marketers, the possibility that you would do a mailing and that it would hit on the first try is incredibly low.
Yeah.
I mean, usually you need to test many, many, many concepts before you hit the one that's actually going to work. So the fact that we put $2,500 in each, did one mailing, and it just happened to be the one that worked, was just incredible good luck. And slowly over the years, we built our organization from that beginning. And at the time that I sold it in 2011, we'd had almost 600,000 young people over that 25-year period come through our live programs from throughout the world, from the fifth grade through college, and not only programs on civics and leadership, but also on various career paths like medicine and law and defense and diplomacy. We were doing programs for fifth grade kids that were teaching them about STEM subjects and science. We were doing amazing things. We built it from just the two of us to an organization of over 200 people.
And this is not to shit on what you've done, because it's been pretty amazing. So this is more of a devil's advocate perspective.
Sure.
Is what about the youth that didn't have the opportunity, right?
Yep.
I feel like, you know, everyone always says, well, these high achievers are always going to be successful because they're high achievers, but it's the ones that don't realize they could achieve are the ones we need to kind of prop up a little bit.
Well, that's one of the things that we were all – the people would say to us, aren't you an elite organization? Doesn't every child deserve this opportunity? And our answer was always – every child does deserve this opportunity, but not from us. We have our niche. We have the people that we serve, and we hope there are others that will serve another niche. But to go to your other point, no, absolutely not. The high-achieving child often gets the short end of the stick and never, ever becomes what they could in life. They are not going to be successful because they have high potential.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the question I have is, how did running this organization, churning out these young adults, hoping to make these high achievers see their potential, how did this actually impact you as a person?
Well, look, I came out of government pretty cynical and kind of worried about the future. And when I started this organization, over the years, I came to be a lot less worried. And I would have people at parties and so on say, oh, you know, kids these days, they're self-centered and they don't do this and that. And I would say, oh, no, 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 no. Let me tell you about my kids. let me tell you about the 30 or 40 or 50,000 young people who come through our programs every year. The vast majority of them are young people who want to make a difference in the world, who want to get involved, who want to be part of the solution. Let me tell you, there's reason to be very optimistic about the future. And that's the impression they made on me. The impression was one of hope and optimism for the future of humanity.
And so, yeah, so I guess that's, to me, like the biggest takeaway from not the biggest, but at least one of the major takeaways from you in terms of just having this career for such a long time in this field is that it actually helped you feel more optimistic about the future over time. But you sold the business. We've actually been talking roughly 50 minutes already. So you sold the business, you said, a few years ago?
2011, we sold the business and then sat out a non-compete and started a new business in 2013.
And same field, same industry, different industry?
I said to myself, I want to keep helping young people, but I want to do something that's bigger, shorter, cheaper, and yet super impactful. And I came up with the idea of stadium events, where we would bring thousands of high-achieving young people all at the same time into a stadium with their parents, not sitting in the same place. The kids would sit by themselves and the parents would sit by themselves. And it was make kind of a mix of a TED conference, a Tony Robbins event, and a rock concert, and put them all together into this happening. And just and so what we ended up doing was we started with medicine. We wanted to inspire young people who were interested in the medical field. And we put the biggest names in the world on that stage, Nobel laureates, deans of medical schools, incredible inventors, fascinating patient stories. We'd broadcast in a live surgery, and which is amazing, and the kids would talk to the doc in real time. And we would then, and what happens is, well, I thought it was going to be great. I thought it was going to be really inspirational. And instead, it turned out to be this magical experience where these young people, a lot of them kind of, you know, super science and math kids and a little bit nerdy and a little lacking in self-confidence and introverted. And they're not really understood, and their parents don't really understand them that well because they don't know what they're talking about. And they walk into this stadium, and all of a sudden, they find their tribe. They find their family. They find a group of young people that love what they love, that are smart the way they are smart, that are passionate the way they're passionate. And what happens in those 3 days, it's a short program, it's just beyond belief.
So, all right, my final question that I have for you, Richard, is one that I ask of everybody. So bear with and do your best.
Oh, no, but I'm so bad at examinations. All right, I'll do my best.
It's not a proctology exam. You're fine. So for where you're at and what you do and who you are as an individual, how do you define happiness?
Well, it's funny. I was asking somebody a few months ago, I said, are you happy? And he said, who's happy? So it's really interesting. To me, happiness is completely inner generated, right? So when I was, 10 years ago, I took my kids out of school and we spent a year traveling the world. And the first place we went was Ghana. Ghana is a terribly poor country, average income $360 a year. And I got off that plane and I thought, everyone is going to be despondent. They're going to be miserable. They're going to be in a state of just terrible negative. No, they were happy, really, really happy, smiles on everyone. And I realized They had strong families, strong community. This was their life. They had hope, they had dreams. And that really taught me and the kids and Lisa that happiness is 100% from within and really has nothing to do with your external situation. And it's the one thing that you get to choose, as Frankl said, is the way you react to any situation.
Well, and I think that's a really powerful lesson. I talk about that all the time with my children. Well, listen, Richard Rossi, CEO, co-founder, founder, because I don't know if your wife is a co-founder of this to your business.
Sure, let's throw her a bone.
Of Da Vinci Education out of DC. Thank you for your time, energy, and willingness to sit down with me on Executives After Hours.
It's been a joy.
Have a great day.
Just believe it.
Thanks.
You can do whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. Just believe it. Believe it. You can do whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. Just believe it. Believe it. You can do whatever you want. You can do whatever.